Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast. We're on episode 83. This is the number one comics podcast on AIPTcomics.com. My name is David Brook, and I'm here with a very special guest who's been on the show who knows how many times. He's one of our favorite co-hosts in the wings, on the bench, if you will.
Yeah. Put me in, coach.
Nathan Simmons.
Hey, how's it
how
going?
You doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm full of coffee and I'm ready to talk some comics.
That's exactly how we want people on this show. It's literally part of the contract you sign.
Yeah. It said I have to be full of coffee. That's the phrasing you used.
Once the white of your eyes are brown, we're good to go. So yeah, if you don't know, this is the comic book podcast where we recap the biggest news of the week. Mm-hmm. Every week we review the best books of the week, and we have some special segments too. This week we'll be talking about TKO, two of our favorite TKO books that we've recently read.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know, if you use AIPT 20 on TKO's website, you get 20% off.
Dope.
Yeah. So to start every show, we talk about the biggest news of the week, and this week our top two pieces of news are sort of like carryover news from weeks past, but they are important, I think, to report on. Mm-hmm. In the top of our news, Dynamite came out with a official statement. So Dynamite issued an official statement in which they basically said this is all behind them.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting apology, if you want to call it that. I'll just read it in full.
Yeah, go for it.
It's pretty short. Dynamite Entertainment is a partner in the fight for equality and inclusion. Our company was founded on these core values more than 15 years ago, and they are essential to the creative process, the work of visionary artists and entrepreneurs that we are passionate about. Intolerance has no place in our company or our industry. The impulse behind this brief association was that of helping a friend of many decades and his family, and not how that assistance could potentially affect our valued colleagues, partners, and friends. That association is behind us, and this time has strengthened our resolve to continue working with the most diverse talent in creating the best comics possible. Now, this is a response that took them about 10 days to put out after they basically... Okay, so there's a comic skater that they backed on Indiegogo on their Twitter about 2 weeks ago now, and then lots of people upset on social media especially, and a couple days later they tweeted, in speaking with this person whose name is Cecil, neither one of us realized the cover would be so polarizing. We discussed and are not moving forward with the cover or the campaign. So they discontinued it.
And Forrest, I think, hit the nail on the head last week when he said that first apology kind of smacks of, we're sorry that you guys got upset about it.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people like Mark Russell and others, like Christian Ward, they came out and said, we won't be working with Dynamite anymore once our contracts are up. Specifically, Mark Russell said that. Mm-hmm. So, and then people were like, Mark, is this enough? When they said that they were sorry, in a way. Well, they never actually said they're sorry. But anyway, Mark was like, no, they need to do more. So now there's this new statement. Nathan, we all want to know, because you are the man with the answers. Did they do enough with this statement?
Oh, it's up to me to decide. It is ridiculous to the very idea that they didn't expect a backlash is, I think, completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a lot of this statement that comes off as, we're just trying to do the right thing and you guys are making it difficult.
Right.
It does feel like, I feel like that this is a step towards an apology. There's still not necessarily an apology here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's a lot of buzzwords of like, this is what we believe in, but nothing that full on addresses what people are upset about. And I think that what has happened is Dynamite has, the second that Dynamite decided not to go forward with the cover, that's when then everyone was against them. Because now it's not just, it's not just people saying like, how could you be associated with ComicsGate? Now it's comic skaters saying, how could you, bow to the SJWs, you idiots.
Yeah, on both sides.
this is such a, like, the statement to me is so innocuous as to essentially say, we don't want anyone to be upset with us. But
right. You're right.
I think what would make me happy, and what Mark Russell was kind of hinting at when, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but like Mark Russell and then the creative team for the James Bond book have all basically been like, this is a start, but it's not what we want.
Right.
And what we want is not necessarily an apology, because those are a dime a dozen. What we want is condemnation of this group that you associated yourself with, because that's the only way that we know that you've, like, you're on our side. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
These people have proven time and again that they don't care about decency. So
right.
It would be nice to hear Dynamite say, just straight up, we fucked up.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be associated with people like this.
I think they need to, actions speak louder than words too.
Sure.
I think that they need to do that and do something, some action that proves their words are true, because especially around Comicsgate stuff, we've seen it with creators who are associated with it. They try to play both sides too. And speaking in vagaries gets you nowhere.
Right. Saying some, I don't know, there's a lot of vagaries in the statement. There's a lot of, like, it doesn't seem fair to leave something like this open to interpretation. You know what I mean? Like, it all smacks of lip service right now instead of any actual momentum, forward momentum. So
AIPT, when this came out, we came out against this and said we would not be covering books by Dynamite. We're covering Dynamite in general until more action is taken. I don't think they've done enough yet. We are open to bringing them back in because, of course, there are creators that write under this label that, you know, they deserve to be heard too. But we don't want to be setting a precedent that we're just going to go along with whatever these publishers want to do when they want to do something and when they want to associate themselves to something so horrible. So yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic that something might happen. Unfortunately, I know from talking with other people in comics journalism that, you know, for months on end now, people have been talking behind closed doors how, you know, they're associated with CG. So it's not like it's new. It's not like it just came out of nowhere. And they need to do a lot more to back up the fact that they are no longer going to be associating with CG.
Or that they. Again, I think a lot of it comes back to they're looking at this from a business perspective, and they're not sure which will hurt them more in the long run. But I promise you that, like, I can't imagine a scenario where, like, not taking a stance against Dynamite or it's taking a stance against Comicsgate doesn't put you on the right side of history.
You know, to add fuel to the fire, just 3 days ago, Tess Fowler tweeted a video of the Cecil guy, as well as Ethan Van Sciver and others like Art Thibbert, laughing about her having cancer. And it's an act of God that she deserves. And it's like, when I saw this, I was like, well, this is a good time for Dynamite to go even harder against this stuff. And they would win so many points on the internet because... it would be a great time to go against this, and yet they didn't. They've just sat quietly, which further just proves that they probably don't mean what they say.
And a few days ago, Ryan Cady tweeted, "This is what it's always been about. Every gate, every quote, the SJWs are the real meanies campaign. Every poorly disguised notion of reasonable centrism, it's an excuse to put on the mask of rationalism and cause harm." And I don't know. I think that kind of hits the nail on the head where it's always, there's always a, you know, there's always an excuse for why they're the ones in the right. You know what I mean? Like, every time I read a Comicsgate argument, it's always, this is forced diversity. This is, you know, this is what's wrong with comics. And it just never seems like there's any kind of, like, rationality, but they act like they are. They're gatekeepers. They're the worst kind.
Which is why, you know, I think Tom King last week rushed to voice concern about Jay Lee, who's done covers for Comicsgate folks
sure.
in the past, doing a Rorschach cover. And just to mm-hmm. carry that news forward a little bit more, on Sunday, Jay Lee Instagrammed his reaction and his response to the whole thing, and he was quite angry. I could see why. I mean,
yeah.
His career is literally being put on the line because people are saying, you know, oh, you're supporting a hate group. So then Tom right. King posted a public apology and also deleted all of the tweets previously mm-hmm. in regards to Jay Lee.
Right. And what I actually really appreciated about that was he left the tweets up long enough to give them context, where he actually posted a thing where he's like, look, I wanted everyone to know the full story of where I fucked up before I deleted these tweets. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? This was a weird thing to watch play out. I just feel like, you know, there is a little bit of like a leeway because Lee's not on most social media platforms, right? Like he said
right.
he's not familiar with Comicsgate or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I tend to believe that. Like I wonder, because whenever I talk to someone who's not on Twitter about Comicsgate, they're like, hang on, what? They're mad about milkshakes, like, you know?
Yeah, because they talk in code, right?
A lot of the time, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and I was trying to explain to my girlfriend, I was not mansplain, but I was trying to tell her about all this like drama that was going on with Dynamite and Tom King and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, it's at the point where like if you want to talk about them on social media, you what you want to do is censor it like it's a swear word so that they don't find you in their search.
Right, right. Yeah, you throw symbols into the words. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine someone who's not, you know, on Twitter would probably not have an idea of how disgusting it's become. But I also feel like it's a hot conversation topic. So it's very right. difficult to kind of figure out where maybe he knew about it, but didn't know, you know, the extent of how bad it's gotten
I think part of me is like, I think about how Jay Lee is and other, a lot of creators are up there in their ages. They're in their 50s or sure. even 60s. And, you know, knowing my, you know, older family members like that, mm-hmm. first of all, they don't care about the day-to-day social media stuff. And mm-hmm. second of all, they don't even know how to use technology. So I could see how that is true, too. But mm-hmm. you're right. Like, at the same time, how has he not heard about this?
Right.
And, you know, even if he has an agent that sets this stuff up to mm-hmm. do covers for Ethan Van Shiver's Battletoad or whatever the thing is called.
Cyberfrog,
sorry.
Don't you dare besmirch the name of Battletoads.
even then, though, like, it's like, how, I don't know, it's like, how do you not, in your statement, go, hey, also, you know, screw Comicsgate.
Right.
That didn't even get uttered by him. And again, it's like,
it's the same issue with the Dynamite apology.
Is he playing both fields so he doesn't want to hurt anybody and thus hurt sales in any regard?
What I will say is that I think that there is a little more leeway for Lee just because of his like his lack of social media presence. Dynamite, there's no way Dynamite didn't know that this was going to be an issue. With Lee, I would like to give the benefit of the doubt, mm-hmm. I think in this situation, we're going to have to wait and see what happens going forward. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know. I respect Tom King for making issuing an apology. I kind of wish he had like checked on that first before it all blew up, but
that's how I felt too. Yeah.
It just seems, I don't know. It seems like there's enough problems with that sector of comics fandom without us kind of doing a he said, she said thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I think it was good that he did an apology.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course, the whole situation is just a mess at this point, and I'm sure everybody wants to just forget it even started.
Well, and the other thing is the as is the case with these things that play out almost exclusively through Twitter feeds. If you missed one part of that whole thing that played out, it still can affect someone's career. You know what I mean? Like the number of people, you know, who's to say people who saw the original tweet didn't see the apology tweet, or, you know what, you know, it's just, it's a mess, and it feels, it's so close to feeling like high school drama.
No, you're right. Totally.
That it is one of those things that I think maybe should have been handled internally before it was a big social media mess, you know.
I wrote pieces of news, like I think 4 pieces of news around this.
Yeah.
And
because it came out piecemeal like that.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, I actually got criticized on Sunday for writing a story on Jay Lee's response.
Uh-huh.
And my response was I'm trying to just say the facts.
Right.
And
not editorialize.
How many fans of Tom King saw that, don't go on Twitter every day,
right?
And still to this day think Jay Lee is a terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I feel like doing as much as I can to put out each piece as it comes out is smart. Although I guess the best reporting would have been wait a couple days, then write an article. Don't be so reactionary.
Well, I think that's how this whole thing got started was
yeah.
A gun got jumped somewhere.
You know? Yeah. And then the race was off.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of races, IDW Publishing. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no, sorry. No, not that kind of race. IDW Publishing, oddly, fired their president and COO and publisher, stepped down a day before Comic-Con at Home started last week.
Right.
And even he tweeted, huh, this came much sooner than I thought. And we reported on that last week. And then he was replaced by 3 different people doing each part of his job. And Judd Myers was one of the people who was actually hired for as publisher. As
publisher, yeah.
And 5 days later, IDW puts him on administrative leave, which is very odd.
Right.
It was reported by The Hollywood Reporter. And immediately, almost everyone was like, huh, this is very strange. And Bleeding Cool and the Comics Beat both ran stories about how this guy, Judd Myers, may or may not be involved in embezzlement with comic stores. And, you know, then I think other people...
I missed all of that.
I saw comic writers were coming out. A writer or two came out on Twitter and said, oh, there's more. There are women who are going to come forward.
Oh, man.
Nothing official has come out about either of those things. I know even the Comics Beat, they kind of tiptoed around this stuff too.
Sure.
This guy's been in the comic industry for decades. He's close friends with Geoff Johns. And I don't know. I don't know how this is going to play out. He's on administrative leave for only a little while. So when he comes back, maybe IDW will post another statement. But not only did it seem strange that they let Chris Royale go early, but then... To put this guy in place in a high power position, and he's only been at the company for a few months in sales, it's just all of it just seems weird and fishy, and there's something else going on.
There is something else going on. I mean, and it's funny because, you know, when Chris Ryle stepped down, there were all of the. I saw so many tweets from different creators who had worked with IDW or like knew Ryle personally who were just saying stuff like, yeah, they're going to need 3 people to do his job. Is apparently he had his hand in everything.
Right.
So when I saw that Myers had been put on administrative leave, I thought immediately, I was like, well, maybe they just realized very quickly that it was a bad fit and they're trying to figure out, you know, who takes over next. But yeah, there's all these, like, I don't know, it does feel like there's so many specifics that aren't being mentioned here, and I don't know that we'll, I mean, we might not ever find out what's going on with this, but, you know, it does seem like it's the kind of thing that gets conspiracy theories brewing.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I think the Comics Beat fueled a lot of those conspiracy theories with their article, where they said that there was a lawsuit against him by a former business partner.
And see, that's, so, this is the first I'm hearing about this. Yeah.
Yeah, this was posted by The Beat on the 28th of July. So yeah, it's possible that powers that be at IDW that make these choices were like, they didn't know about these things. Somehow they came to light within 5 days of hiring him and then moved swiftly. So I feel like IDW is probably making the right call by putting him on administrative leave as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Rather than other publishers who may have let him just continue on for weeks, if not months,
right,
and say nothing and pretend like it's not happening. If it's financially connected, though, I could see how this is even more of a big deal to IDW than you know, sexual harassment or other kind of cases like that, especially with someone of such high stature. But yeah, as their new publisher, it's not a good first move. Although,
So
their books are licensed now, so it's not like they're,
yeah,
it's not like they're, you know, writing the new Shakespeare or anything.
Right. Yeah, it's weird. I tend to get a kick out of IDW books. But it does seem like there's always been issues with, I feel like they've always had issues on the editorial side, just in terms of like long-term planning. And so I don't know if this is just more of the same or what the deal is. Yeah, it's very strange. The timing is very strange.
I tell you, it was weird. I watched two IDW panels at Comic-Con at home, and Chris Royale was on both.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it just further proves, like, he was let go way earlier
before he was supposed to be. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's a bad look.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Let's have our now let go president and CEO, COO and publisher talk about the future of IDW.
Wow.
Anyway, it's an interesting story that will likely
continue to
develop.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Also in the news, the X-Men were nominated for a design award. Tom Muller, who has now famously redesigned the X-Men logo across all their books, he revealed that he was nominated for a publisher award for the BIAs.
Brand Impact. What is it?
There you go. I looked at the website where this was originally posted.
Yeah.
And it appears there's only one other competitor.
Oh.
Which is the Guardian, where they did the Guardian newspaper, and they did a Hope is Power campaign,
which
was also quite good. But
yeah.
I was kind of surprised there was only two nominees for the category.
Well, I mean, you know, who's doing a whole lot of advertising this year that's not just telling people to please wash your fucking hands? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, you're right. You're right. I have a feeling it'll win. It'll probably win.
It's great. It's a great look. I mean, I'm a sucker for consistency,
yeah.
Especially like on a branding level. I've been very happy with, I mean, like we've talked about this before. I've been a lapsed X-Men fan for years, and there's something about, seeing those books like line up so nicely, even though sometimes the timelines can be a little wonky because of COVID and everything, you know, publishing delays and stuff. But like seeing a unified style on those covers, it just really like draws me in.
It's funny you reminded me, like when there are multiple books in a line, like the X-Men, the cover the logos tend to be wildly different.
Sure, yeah.
And so, like, the brand identity is lost.
Right.
So it's a great way to, like, pull it all together, even if the stories and art and whatnot are just completely wildly different.
Well, that's why I enjoy seeing the Sandman Universe banner over a lot of the Black Label books. Like, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I'm catching up with these guys again, you know?
Right, right.
I don't know. It does have a very, I mean, the books themselves couldn't be more different, like, across the line. But having that similar branding really does make it feel cohesive.
We'll find out on September 10th if the X-Men win and Tom Muller win.
Sweet.
This award. So it's coming up. Next in the news, bad idea. New publisher.
Yeah.
They were supposed to launch, I think, in May. And of course, they had to put that on hold because If you don't know, Bad Idea's entire approach is comic book store only, digital, no trade paperbacks, only single issues, and only in select stores. I think it's about 50 stores across the nation that were selected.
And originally it was 20, right? Wasn't it?
It was much lower, And I have to say, the closest store, and I live very close to Boston, like a five-minute drive to some of the biggest comic stores in our area. I still live 45 minutes away from the nearest Bad Idea store.
I think Forest was like four states away from. I am consistently baffled by Bad Idea.
So Bad Idea, they keep coming up with these crazy marketing ideas. So far, we haven't seen a Bad Idea comic that we can judge, but we have seen Bad Idea marketing campaigns. And this week they launched a new one.
This is
called The Button.
This is wild.
I can't. So if you go to AFGTcomics.com and look this up, if you look up The Button, it'll come up in the news. So essentially, they created a website where there's a big red button, and they are waiting for us. You can actually click it and it makes a ding sound. They're waiting for the number to get up to 1 billion clicks before Bad Idea can continue their company. Apparently, the button
is
taken
sentient.
Over. As of this recording, we're at 379 million. So we're almost, we're like practically there.
I mean, kudos to whoever wrote this copy, because it is... It's wild. I mean, they've created a whole lore behind it. And then they also, like, I mean, the button is, like, negging the audience. Because, like, there's a bit in there where it's like, you're kidding yourself if you thought Joker was any good, you fucking nerd. Like, there's... It's wild.
Talks about Magic Mike.
I don't know. I mean, I think that there is some really interesting concepts behind Bad Idea, and I feel for them, because I do know how clearly derailed their marketing plans have become because of COVID-19. I mean, because the idea is that we want to get books directly into the hands of regular readers. We don't want to, like, rely on any gimmicks, and unfortunately, because of lockdowns and, you know, health and safety concerns, they're having to lean on a gimmick, you know, to like get people to drum up interest. And to be fair, as absurd as the button is, I really enjoy just the sheer willingness to be silly about it. It really kind of endears me to Bad Idea, but I am I'm consistently baffled. By them.
I mean, let's be honest. We're talking about it right now, so it's worked in some capacity.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. No. Exactly. You sent me this earlier this week, and I was literally like laughing the whole time I was reading this, and not in like a laughing at them kind of way. I was just like, the chutzpah, like, to do this. It's just pretty great.
We had shop manager Jill on last week from Kamikaze, Eisner winning store, to talk, and we actually brought this up, Bad Idea, and it's interesting. She's kind of, it's curious to her, but it's not like she's dying to go buy their books.
That's kind of where I'm at too.
I mean, you know, all these marketing ploys and crazy ideas to get you to listen to them is one thing, but she said, like, it's all going to be about how good the books are and if people want them. The thing I worry, and Forrest too, I think we worry about, is like, this is just prime for someone to buy issues and sell them on eBay for $500.
Right. Well, and you know, as much as I think the concept of, oh, we're never going to collect these books from prestige writers, you know, like they've got, they've got like people like Peter Milligan doing books for them, is interesting. It's a cool,
I don't trust them, honestly.
But and the thing is, like, do you, you put out a limited run of this first book, anyone who misses that first book is very unlikely to buy the second issue. So you have repeat customers, but it's very difficult to create new customers with that business model. How it seems to me anyway.
Judging by the wild ideas they have for marketing, when I say I don't trust them, I mean, I don't believe that they will never reprint all the books in a trade.
Well, yeah, I think their PR guy said something like, that's not in the plans right now, you know, or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Like, I think it is like we're leading the charge with brand new stuff, get it while it's hot. And then eventually maybe we'll, you know, release them in another fashion.
Like the energy and the like personality that they keep throwing off, I could see them being like, see, it's a new book entirely. It's not actually a trade of the single issues because we've changed the title.
Or you know, like something or we added like in that. We added in some extra pages or yeah.
Or every book comes with a candy bar, so it's not actually a comic. It's food. Ha ha ha.
You know,
something like that.
Honestly, that would work on me. I mean,
it probably would.
If you put out a comic book that came with a bag of Pop Rocks, I'm there.
Well, speaking of partying and candy and fun, Tom Taylor,
you are so
sure
good at segues, bro.
who's good is Tom Taylor. He's really good at teasing. The guy practically like that's like his second job.
He loves it.
And I noticed this week in particular, I haven't really been paying attention with his other campaigns with like Seven Secrets and Deceased. But this week, his teasing was annoying fans, and they were like, just freaking tell us already.
Yeah.
So he's been teasing letters on his Instagram, mm-hmm. Twitter, and Facebook, mm-hmm. which every day he posts one white letter on a black background, and it spells out JSA, right?
Yeah. The first? Well, originally he did the same thing he was doing with Deceased, where he would put out like lines of dialogue, and out of context, you know, and it was always something sort of innocuous but depressing, like Batman saying like, "I wish they were still here," you know, like
right.
But for the first couple of days, he put like an I and then an N, and everyone was like, "Fucking injustice!" And then he put a Z to be a dick, and it was really funny. Like he was clearly trolling people. And then yesterday his Instagram spelled out JSA.
Right. And then he also posted a little bit of art. Mm-hmm. He posted Amazing Man. Was it
Amazing Man? Yeah.
And yeah. Then
he also there was also a piece. It looks like Batman, Nightwing, and Superman, which would definitely put that as a prequel to Injustice, if that's what that's for.
So then comicbook.com on Friday accidentally posted news and then took it away.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can get away with that, apparently, if you have the scoop and then you take it away. But unfortunately, the way the internet works, people see things and then start spreading it.
Right.
And it looks as though this book will be called Injustice Year Zero.
Yeah. And CBR, like yesterday, just straight up said, like the headline was DC announces Injustice Year Zero, and then you click on it and like the just you know like I mean they were just like, look, this hasn't been confirmed, but we all know this is happening. And that's kind of been the tone of, you know, everyone reporting on Year Zero lately. Is just, I mean, I think the one you put up yesterday was basically like, I mean, no one's said that this is what's up, but I mean, we can look at the artwork and we know that it's happening.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that comicbook.com pulled it and then didn't post it later in the day, because these teases tend to start Monday and then go up Friday so people can talk about it all over the weekend.
Right, of course.
But they never put it back up, so we're still lying in wait, waiting for this official release. But according to Newsarama, who reported on this, the artists will be Roge Antonio, Cyan Tormey, Rain Barreto, and Wes Abbott on letters. With covers by the amazing Julian Totino Tedesco.
Yeah.
So I'm all for Amazing Man. I'm all for this idea. I am a little hesitant just because I'm not a super Injustice fan, but I did dabble in Tom Taylor's run on Injustice, which obviously connects to the video game.
So I think Tom Taylor's Injustice soars once he was able to move past the basic setup of the game, because the game is so grimdark, and once he got to the point where he was like, okay, now I don't have to keep justifying evil Superman, I can just tell my own stories, that's when the book gets so good to me. I still haven't read the Injustice 2 series, which I've heard is really fun, but I mean, once Tom Taylor was basically just given a sandbox, and you know, and so that's how we get stuff like, you know, John Constantine, like brainwashing Superman and stuff like that. Like, there's just some really fun stuff.
And there's a complete edition you can get if you wanted to get it all in one.
I do, and I shall. It's the same thing with Deceased is like, here's my pitch, zombies in the DC universe, but really I just want to do this book about Green Lantern, Black Canary, which is, I'm fine with that happening. I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm a sucker for Golden Age stories, and there's artwork that shows the Justice League throwing down with the JSA. Mm-hmm. This Wildcat design that looks like a shitty homemade boxing uniform, which I'm super into. Amazing Man punching Hitler will never not be great. Anyone punching Hitler will never not be great.
This is true. Even like Stewie from Family Guy.
Let's do it.
Get your pens out, artists. It's also worth noting this is going to be a digital first book. I think the Harley Harley Quinn Black and White and Red,
which is great. Is
so good. So good.
I was really shocked by it. I genuinely, when I saw it announced, I was like, I don't know if that style works for this character, but everyone's done just something really interesting with it. I've been really enjoying
it. Do you think DC's going to continue to unveil new digital first books? It's almost like a new imprint.
Yeah. At this point,
Label. With the pandemic, they would be smart to just keep pushing these kind of things.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been really enjoying Batman, The Adventures Continue, even though it's a continuity nightmare fans of the animated series. But DC, I think, has been crushing it with their digital first books, and then I can, pick them up bundled down the line, which is nice.
Right. Yeah. We can only hope. They haven't actually announced if they'll be collected, but I'm sure they will be.
I feel like they will. Yeah.
It's also interesting, referring to our guest last week on mm-hmm. Kamikaze, she was saying, DC is very inconsistent on when their books actually arrive. Of course, that's not just DC's fault. It's the people who are shipping the books.
Right.
But this is adding consistency to DC, and mm-hmm. I wonder if that's on their mind, because every Friday we get the new Harley book. Who knows when this will come out? Maybe Wednesdays, maybe Tuesdays. It's like if they keep littering the offerings in these digital things, at least they can stick to that while they continue to figure out their shipping schedules.
Well, and like you said, when you get those digital books on Fridays, it becomes a talking point for the weekend.
Right.
I think that you release your new books in the middle of the week, like physically, and then you put your digital books out at the end of the week, and basically there's not a period of the week where DC is not in the conversation, which I think is a really smart move.
For sure. Also a smart move.
Yeah.
Scott Snyder moving away from DC's central line in 2021. Mm-hmm. He revealed to Games Radar. That's sort of an inside joke to switch that. Anyway, he's revealed that he's going to move away from the mainline book. So when I first saw this news, I was like, oh my God, he's quitting DC. He's going to Marvel. Yes, we're going to get a Spider-Man book from Scott Snyder. But no, that's not true. he simply said he's moving away from the big title books, probably going to be mm-hmm. doing more Vertigo. As we already know, he's doing American Vampire.
Right.
Starting this fall.
So excited for that.
He's been talking about bringing that back for, 5 years now. He's been saying it's coming. I know when he was on this podcast a little over a year ago.
Yeah.
We spent a chunk of that interview just talking about how he wants to get back to Vertigo. He wants to get back to doing books at Image.
He wanted to get back to Witches too. Was another thing that he's been talking about forever.
Since then he's only done mainline Justice League books, mm-hmm. Dark Death Metal.
Yeah,
and so I can imagine it's been wearing on him for a while.
Well, yeah,
so it's not a big surprise.
I'm sure he's excited to not have the future of DC Comics in his hands, you know what I mean? It did not have to to push forward all of the big characters. I'm sure that must be super freeing. I'd love to see him do some more Swamp Thing some more Black Label stuff or whatever. Just anything that's a little bit of a passion project instead of these. I mean, I know he loves writing the big wacky cosmic books, but I'm sure being able to scale down is super freeing in a way.
Right, for sure. He's also, actually, if you go back, I highly recommend listening to that interview because it's still, somehow, it's still pertinent over a year later.
Right,
He talked a lot about the book he's working on with Frank Villa, which is about like a screenwriter, and it's like a mystery, and there's a monster. He's spoken about it briefly here and there, but he talked about it quite a bit on the show. I'm really psyched for that, especially because they worked together quite a bit way back in the day,
right.
And it'll be cool to see them link back up.
Right.
But this is perfect segue. Oh my god! So Razor Blades came out this week, and you're gonna go, wait, what's Razor Blades? Never heard of that. That's because no one knew about it until Thursday at noon.
What a wild surprise! When I saw it pop up on Twitter, I was just like, how was this a secret?
So interestingly, there is an interview with Tinian and Scott Snyder. Tinian interviews Scott Snyder, and it's incredibly well timed, I think, because Newsarama reveals Scott's going to pull away from the mainline books. Mm-hmm. The very next day, Razor Blades has an interview where he talks about horror, not only just horror. I mean, he talks about Batman and why he works, but also the horror in Batman.
Right.
And you get this vibe that, like, you know, his life isn't about just superheroes in this interview. And but what is Razor Blades? Razor Blades is a new horror anthology magazine. That isn't just comics. It's not just short comic stories. It also has prose, pinups, and obviously stuff like interviews.
Yeah.
So it's a 75, 80-page-ish magazine. You can buy it right now at readrazorblades.com. It's curated by James Tinian and Steve Fox.
I mean, it's comics superstars doing a fanzine. I mean, essentially, like, doing, like, a horror, like, fanzine, and it's so dope.
More importantly, probably for a lot of people right now, because our wallets are so thin, it's pay what you want.
Right.
Similar to the panel syndicates format over the last couple of years, which is great. I think once you pick this up, you might want to go back and give them even more money because the value is quite high on this book, I would say.
Yeah.
I reviewed the whole thing, and I don't typically write super long reviews, but it ended up being very long.
Yeah. There's just you wanted to so break down much all content. Of them, too. Yeah, of course.
I mean, this first magazine issue, so it's a quarterly magazine issue, so we'll get another one in the Halloween times.
Right.
But it has some of the biggest titans in horror comics today. Ram V, Danny, Lonnie Nadler, Tinian, of course. It's just, the list goes, it would take me like 2 minutes to say all the names.
Yeah.
Aaron Campbell from, Hellblazer. Have you seen that Hellblazer comic, Nathan?
Oh, yeah. I think I've peeked at it a couple of times.
Yeah, Nathan, you've been reviewing every issue.
I have.
And a lot of them have tens, so you guys know.
It's consistently my favorite book on the shelf. I'm so excited for that Tom Taylor miniseries that's coming up, too. The new Black Label miniseries.
Oh, yes, the Hellblazer one, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Razor Blades, really cool idea, really cool concept. Also, not run by any publishers. This is Tinian and Fox on their own. Obviously, this sprouted from the pandemic when a lot of creators didn't have any work and it was pencils down. And so it's also helping creators, you know, stay afloat a little bit.
Well, and everyone is putting, like, everyone's bringing their A game. Like, it is, there's nothing that feels like, you know, with a lot of anthologies, sometimes you feel like something was a little dashed off or it was like contractually obligated or something. But everyone seems so into what they're doing. The other one I was trying to remember was the Baby Blue story that had the there's so many different types of artwork. There's some like mixed media in here, and it's candy for a horror fan. It really is.
It's like it's celebration of the medium in a way.
Absolutely.
I love the name of it too. Like the idea that every single story cuts a little bit, like Razor Blade.
Yeah, no, I mean, I literally, halfway through one of the stories, I had to, like, step away from my laptop that I was reading it on, because I was just like, man, that one really got me. My skin was crawling.
I was reading it at, like, 2 a.m. I was like, okay, I should probably put this down.
Right.
In our last bit of news, Scenic Grace has added to his Tumblr a new, I would call it a letter, about his time at Marvel Comics. As you might know, think about, geez, what was it?
It was about a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about it on this very show where he had exited Marvel. A couple weeks later, he revealed what was going on and the shitty situation he was in and the shitty way they treated him. Well, he's added a new anecdote to this, in part because the editor who is in this story asked him not to share it at the time. So he's sort of adding on to it, sort of like chapter two.
And then that editor has since left Marvel and said, like, go ahead.
He basically is sharing the fact that marginalized creators are not getting treated fairly or in the right way, even though Marvel continues to try to preach that they're doing a good job at it. Cena is just trying to shed more light on it and that it's still on an unhealthy place for marginalized creators.
Yeah. You know, for a place that calls itself, I mean, I think that that's something he brings up is that it's called the House of Ideas, and it just feels like that there's still so much closed-mindedness happening.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not surprising. I mean, considering these giant companies are continually run by, you know, straight men, and not only that, but people who have been in the industry for so long,
right.
Change is hard, and they probably don't even see... or they may not see the need for it.
Right.
In his anecdote here, he talks about how he tried to get a kid's book, a Spider-Man kid's book.
Yeah.
And they told him he was going to get it, or he had the chance to get it, and then it just sort of fizzled and fell apart.
Which I wonder, was that the Marvel Action books? Or like, I'm trying to think of what that could have been.
I couldn't have been Spidey, because that had only one writer. I forget. Was it Nick Robles or something?
I think.
I'm not sure, honestly. But
it's strange, though, because he was given like a series of kind of half answers about why he wasn't allowed to be on the book. At one point, someone told him, you don't have any experience writing all ages books. And he's like, actually, I've edited all ages books, written this, illustrated that. And then the most telling thing was at one point he just straight up asked the person who told him no, like, do you believe what you're telling me? Like, do you believe what they've asked you to tell me? Like, what do you think the real reason is why I'm not getting this work?
Yeah.
And it just seems like it was a series of like closed doors, and even the stuff he was doing that was like attracting attention from readers. And it just seems like he was constantly being boxed in as a queer creator. I mean, it's literally, I think in his Tumblr post last year, even the people who were happy with his work on Iceman were telling him, well, we're going to try to get you like a real book or something like that. And he's like, well, no, like this matters to me. I just also want, you know, I want you guys to like recognize that I'm putting the work in and that I know what I'm doing.
It's crazy to me. Like, when he was still writing Iceman, he was one of the hardest working hype men I've ever seen on social media. He was constantly pushing his books, getting the word out,
and he does that with everything he does. I follow him on Instagram, and he just, you know, sold a bunch of these prints that he made for he illustrated like a full series of prints for the musician Jenny Lewis, and he did, you know, he sold them off for like charity, and he I don't know, anytime he's involved in anything, he's literally like, guys, go check this out. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I see Ghosted in LA in my Instagram feed, because like he loves what he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just unfortunate. Hopefully this letter helps. I don't know if it will, but
yeah,
it's just another example of how, like, you might think everything is fine and, you know, companies are acting morally and ethically correct, and might not be the case.
Right.
And I don't know how, as readers, we can do anything except for, I guess, talk about it on our podcast and let people know about it. If you go to Cena Grace's Tumblr, it's cenagrace.tumblr.com. You can read the latest post, which was posted just 12 hours ago from this recording.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, in our next segment, this is called TKO Corner. We've only done this segment once.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we're going to talk about TKO books that we're reading that we think you should read too. And again, like I said at the top of the show, if you go to TKO and buy any of their books, if you use the discount code AIPT20, you'll get 20% off.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about Seven Deadly Sins.
Let's do it.
I got to read this. They sent this to me, FYI. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big Western fan. I've I've seen probably almost every Western there is.
Did not know this about you.
Yeah, there's something about the lawlessness, right? And like the fact that like anything could happen.
Sure.
You know, within reason, of course. But like, it's not like today where you could just, you know, take your horse and ride for 4 days and then build a house and then get murdered by bad people.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Seven Deadly Sins, it is a Western. It's set in the 1800s, 1867 to be exact, Texas. And the title, Seven Deadly Sins, it just evokes to me like a Tarantino idea.
Yeah.
Where there are these characters that each one represents a different sin. Sloth and, you know, all the others, I forget. I'm not a religious man.
Oh, fair enough.
Anyway. It is written by Tzi Chun, who this is his first book, and it's drawn by Artyom Trakhanov.
Mm-hmm.
It's visually a delight. It's colored magnificently.
Yeah, I saw that from the preview pages. It's wild.
Yeah. I keep saying this recently. I don't know why. Eduardo Russo is on my mind a lot for some reason, especially with the TKO books. I said this too with Pound for Pound. The style kind of reminds me of his work, similar to like 100 Bullets, where there's a slight cartoonishness to the way they're rendered, and yet their faces are very unique and
super just expressive.
Very stable. Yeah. It's like the kind of art that you'd want for a lot of dialogue and a lot of character building, and you see that from page one. Anyway, the book itself, I love the concept. I love how unique it is. And the visual style is just exceptional. It just feels like a different kind of Western. And, you know, that's something I think a lot of people who tend to not like Westerns don't like, is that so many Westerns are the same. It's the gunslinger, it's the lawlessness, the revenge tale, et cetera, et cetera. This one's about these characters breaking out of prison, some of which you'll root for, some of which you won't, even though they are technically protagonists that you're supposed to be rooting for.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complex story, and I could see why Tzi Chun wrote this coming from film. I could totally see this being a film. It has a unique perspective and a unique premise, and it just draws you in. And I think it's just another example of how Westerns can do different kinds of stories, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the show.
Yes, yeah. I was just thinking that.
So I highly recommend checking it out.
Cool.
It's called The Seven Deadly Sins. And as with every TKO book, you can get it in single issues or in the trade format.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a TKO book?
I did. Yeah, I actually just... I was looking through their catalog because you guys were talking them up last week, and I saw, I'm a sucker for, I love anything Jeff Lemire works on. So I had to check out Sentient, and then I saw that you gave it a 10 out of 10. And so I was like, okay, well, that's definitely the one I'm going to read. yeah. It's by Jeff Lemire and Gabriel Hernandez Walta on doing the artwork. And it is this incredible story of a group of kids who are stranded in space. They're on a colony ship heading from Earth to this new colony planet, and one of the parents on board the ship is this separatist terrorist who kills all of the other adults on board, and the children are rescued by the ship's AI that slowly comes to care for them like a parent. And
it's doing its best.
It's doing its best. Like there's sequences where it is just saying, "I'm so sorry," like over and over again. Please don't cry. Like it's overwhelmed. And this AI Val has no discernible face, but the way the dialogue is written, you can feel the pain and the psychological torment, but it's also a very sweet story. It is about how these kids are like thrust into this situation and become a family. And it does feel like there's moments where the story skims over things to like make you wonder, well, what happened during that time? Why are they, there's a moment where one of the narrator says like, we had to do things to make it home. It's stuff like that where it's just like, there's so much loaded in like certain sentences where you are like, oh, you could do a whole other book about this day that they're talking about, or this, you know, mm-hmm. It's so dense, but at the same time, it is, it's so well paced that the, it never feels like you're being overloaded with, exposition. It's a very, I don't know, it's so wild how, what a full story is told in like, what, like 100 pages, I think. It actually like made me emotional while I was reading it. And I haven't like mm-hmm. felt that with a book in a, I mean, very, very rarely have I felt that reading something in a while. And it does that thing that all the other TKO books do where it's, you know, it's broken up into chapters. So it does feel like,
episodic.
Yeah. But I read it all in one sitting. Like I literally
me too.
Couldn't, yeah.
I couldn't put it down.
Yeah. It's great. And
I love how whenever like a robot or something like that shouldn't be human is something that you actually like connect with.
Yes.
In Val. Like I was amazed by how I felt for the robot, even though it's just a robot.
Right. And Walt's artwork is so good. It has that similar thing where like everyone's very expressive, everyone's wide eyed, and you know, it also does this thing that I love in science fiction where like we see all this stuff in like Star Trek where it's this beautiful, pristine future. And I like the shitty, functional version of the future where like the ship they're on is like, I mean, they're basically in like a tenement building in space, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah, it's run down.
It's
for
like
sure.
The Nostromo or something. Like it has that kind of feel where it's all very function over form. I really appreciate that. It helps ground the story more.
I think that's one reason why a lot of people gravitate towards Star Wars, right? Over
sure.
Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's more understandable.
Yeah, you're less likely to run into a Han Solo type in Star Trek. Like it just feels right. More, I mean, I remember as a kid, like when I got a Boba Fett action figure when I was a kid, I thought that like the figure itself was damaged because the paint was like chipped on. And I was like, no, that's how he looks in the movie. Like he looks like shit. And that there's so much, atmospheric storytelling that comes from that, where it's you know, it's like when you're playing a video game or like The Last of Us or something, and you just see like there's all these notes like scattered around that tell me about the terrible things that happened here, and that's just like the visual version of that is seeing like you know, a piece of armor that's like torn up, or the ship mm-hmm. in Sentient looking dusty and nasty, like something out of 2000 AD like on the outside. I really, really enjoyed that. I was glad that this gave me an excuse to check out something new.
Yeah, and you know, it's just a reminder too, when creators get the chance to tell the full story before releasing, it feels more robust. The pace is more even keeled. I mean, so often when you're reviewing single issue mm-hmm. stories, a lot of the time, like you've got an issue that kind of falters because it's not being held up by the rest of the narrative.
Right.
And that's one reason why I think a lot of TKO books work better for some, because there's a full story there to get mm-hmm. From cover to cover.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm definitely, that's the first TKO book I've read. I mean, you guys have been talking them up for a little bit, so I'm on board.
Nice. I think Sentient might still be my favorite of all of them though. So mm-hmm. just temper those, you know, expectations
sure.
a little bit. I don't want you to be totally crushed.
You liked Pound for Pound a lot though too, right?
I did, yeah. It was wild, a wild ride. In our next segment, our top books of the week, our top two favorite comics that came out just this week. Nathan, what was your second favorite comic of the week?
My second favorite book of the week was John Constantine Hellblazer number 8, written by Cy Spurrier, art by Aaron Campbell. I love this series. I mean, it's Vertigo, Hellblazer, like it's back. Like I think I've been saying that since it launched. I even tried to make a case for it as the best reboot of last year when I was on for the end of the year wrap up episode. But I don't know. There's something about the way Spurrier writes really poetic dialogue that still doesn't feel cloying. It still feels like real. It shouldn't make this flowery language shouldn't sound right coming from regular people, but the, I don't know, something about the way these stories are told just feels like darkly poetic. The storyline that's been playing out is John has been investigating this guy who has a mermaid has fallen in love with him, and he's a fisherman.
Ugh, I hate when that happens.
You know, it classic tale as old as time. And he works on the docks, and he basically John's been tracking this guy who makes people's dreams come to life. And this guy was hoping for success on the docks, and this mermaid comes to him and starts helping him like harvest the fish that the other fishermen are like taking from him. And then the business starts to dry up, and so he starts cutting pieces off of her because he realizes she'll just heal. Right. And so this storyline has been John tracking this guy down and making him answer up to like what he's done to this person. It feels like almost like a, it feels like a spiritual successor to that Calliope story from Neil Gaiman's Sandman, the one about the muse that's being mistreated. There's some stuff in this in these last few issues that have literally made me like gasp when I would hit like a certain turn of phrase, or just the imagery of it is so dark and upsetting, but also, like I said, it's beautifully rendered. Like, I mean, Aaron Campbell is able to make blood and guts look like a cathartic experience somehow. Like, and especially with this story, like you so badly want this guy to get what's coming to him. Like there was a, I think when my review of number 7 came out, I was either on Twitter or on the comment section at AIPT, but someone was like, yeah, I just really hope this guy gets like torn apart next month. You know, like there, and it is one of those things where it's like, well, that's a really awful thing to think. But by the end of the story, you kind of see where they're coming from.
Right. And that's sometimes that's hard to do.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, I think the reason why John hasn't felt like John for a long time is that there has been a real movement to make him a little more sanitary or a little more sanitized for, you know, he's not
at public consumption.
Yeah. Like a classic Hellblazer is not a marketable character. And I think I think that's why DC has finally just been like, okay, well you write Hellblazer John, and then we'll have DC John running around somewhere else, you know?
Right.
And I mean, the brilliant thing about this book is that Cy Spurrier has made that literal, where we're dealing with a time-displaced version of John Constantine. If anybody hasn't read this book who is like a longtime fan of Hellblazer, like please, you won't regret it. It's super weird and super cynical, but in an oddly beautiful way.
Nice. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I read the first issue, and it was so dense that I was like, I'm going to wait for
the trade. It's crazy dense. Yeah, especially right off the bat, there's so much. It wasn't super accessible like from the jump, because it does rely on. I mean, I remember reading the Hellblazer special that set everything up, and I was like, they're picking up a storyline from a storyline that happened the year I was born. Like they were like picking up. There's threads from Books of Magic, the original series, that are playing out now.
That's crazy. You could tell Spurrier just like cares so much about the character.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is the kind of book that only comes from like a hardcore fan. But it's fantastic.
It's funny. My second favorite book of the week was also, I suppose, steeped in horror.
Yeah,
Hellblazer steeped in horror, right?
Yes. Oh yeah, very much
so. How do you steep your horror? Do you use a bag, or do you use one of those? Spoons?
No, I do the British method as described by Gail Simone. I put it in the microwave. I put my Lipton tea right into the microwave.
Oh God. My second favorite book of the week is Sleeping Beauties number 2. Yeah. This one's by Rio Yours and Alison Sampson. It's an adaptation of Owen and Stephen King's novel.
Yeah.
That's now, I want to say, 3 or 4 years old. I liked the first issue, but I loved the second issue.
Yeah.
This is a 10-part series. So it's definitely a slower boil, a slower reveal of what's going on and its characters. Everything sort of picks up in the second issue, though. We start to see how there are different settings, one of which is in a prison, another which is in the woods. Mm-hmm. It's a story about a pandemic from Australia. Yes, a pandemic from Australia that is striking in America and across the world, where women fall asleep and a cocoon grows around their heads. And if you tear away the cocoon, they go wildly mad and start attacking whoever's there, even if it's their baby. Mm-hmm. And people are, it's just striking in America while this story started to get unveiled. And so the public doesn't really know how to react. And in this issue, there are imagery, there's imagery of people protesting outside the White House. There are people losing their minds over this pandemic. There are people who say it's not real. And I am reading this going, I literally said in my review, first of all, this book was written years ago. Second of all, this book was drawn and adapted months ago, which Allison Sampson, the artist, actually messaged me early in the week and told me so, confirming it.
Yeah.
And yet somehow its imagery, it's somehow its story is like lining up exactly with how we're reacting.
Yeah.
And it's just the horror of it is rendered even more horrific because you can see how real it is. And this is all, this wasn't written by like scientists. This is written by people who write fiction, right? So like they have their thumb on the pulse of humanity when you're reading this.
Well, it's like I just rewatched Night of the Living Dead for the first time in maybe a decade, and the original, and there's a character in the movie who's just like, I think it's all bullshit. You know, he's just basically like, I don't, you know, why don't we go outside and see, you know, it's, and I was just like, yeah, I guess that's, okay. Well, I guess we've always had no self-preservation.
It is funny. Like you watch these old zombie movies and stuff and like, you're always like, oh, they're so stupid for doing that. Well, no. Guess what? Yeah. Real people would have would be doing even more stupid things. They'd be hiding their zombie bite.
Yeah, America then, is the guy who doesn't tell everyone he's been bitten on the leg.
This second issue also delves a little bit into gender identity, which is kind of fascinating. Oh, cool. There's a point where it's brought up, like, it's not just people born women getting these cocoons. Mm. It's people who identify as women, too. Further complicating like how this pandemic even works, and I've never read the source material, so I'm not sure where it's going. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, Allison Sampson's art. If you don't know who she is, she drew Winnebago Graveyard for Image Comics a couple years ago. Very, very striking art. It really affects me. Like, it's not only is it striking because of the colors, which are by, let me look this up so I get it right, Triana Tree Farrell does the colors, but also just the way Sampson renders faces. They're hyper-realistic and yet somehow flat at the same time when compared to the backgrounds. They really pop at you. And there's some vividly interesting full-page spreads and panels in this book where it can make you feel sick. It can make you feel wonderment. And that's all layered on top of already an interesting premise.
Right.
So highly recommend checking out Sleeping Beauties. I think you should probably read it in single issue format. After the first issue, I wasn't so sure because it was just unveiling characters so slowly that I didn't care about a lot of
that
it.
That is a very King thing to do, too.
Yeah. And there's a lot of characters. There's, I want to say there's one, two, three, probably four or five main characters. And they're all in different parts of this town. Of course, a small town in you know, Nowheresville, America, something else King is known for. Not Maine, but it's Appalachia.
Right.
Possibly as bad and ignorant as Maine, though. So I recommend checking that out. What is your favorite book of the week?
Man, Pulp was great.
I know, right?
Pulp by Ed Brubaker, art by Sean Phillips. Man, I mean, should we just go ahead and say that that's also your number one?
Yeah, it was my favorite book of the week as well. I think it's a perfect comic.
It is. Yeah, I think I messaged you the second I finished reading it. No, I messaged you like 10 pages in and I was like, this is the best thing I've read this year.
Yeah, it's something else.
It follows a pulp fiction writer in the 30s who is writing thinly veiled stories about when he was a bandit in the Old West. And he finds out that there's fucking Nazis in New York City and decides to do something about it. I mean, that's the broad strokes of it, but man, it is. The character work in the, and it, again, like I was mentioning with Sentient, there's so many things that are left ambiguous or that he like mentions in passing about, you know, people that he loved or, you know, that are gone now, that he doesn't really get into specifics. And you just get this feeling that this person has lived a whole life and we're just seeing a snapshot of it. The dialogue is unbelievable. And I believe Ed Brubaker based it off of, he had a heart attack in like in the last couple of years, correct?
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so. But the,
yeah, the character suffers a heart attack and, you know, he's an old timer.
Yeah.
and I don't want to give away too right. much because a lot of the book is, it's a cross cut between this old timey Western kind of story sure. where there's a bandit and then this older man in early 1939,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's trying to, you know, it's the Depression. So he's trying to make his way. Mm-hmm. He's writing these Western stories mm-hmm. and making less and less money because, it's become this hit and then they're getting these younger writers to start writing the stories for him.
Stories, which is something that right. happens a lot to older creators in the comics industry.
Right.
It felt, I mean, obviously I assume Ed Brubaker hasn't killed very many people, but the, there's something about this book that felt deeply personal, like throughout.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The way the captions are laid out were particularly like drawing me into the person's persona.
Yeah. Well, and they point to things in the space, like they point to things like whatever he's focusing on in the moment that he's thinking that, that's where the caption mm-hmm. box is as well. And right, I love little tricks of the trade like that.
It's also beautifully colored and drawn. Mm-hmm. It again, it's almost whimsical yeah. or dreamlike,
especially because the flashback this character sequences is, where you barely right. you barely see his face. It's almost like he doesn't remember what he looked like as a young man.
Mm-hmm. And the way the color is sort of laid out, yeah. it's not like perfectly in the lines, right?
Right.
It's like almost splashed on.
And it's sepia without being sepia. Like it's very, it feels like we go into like a, an adventure serial for some of these, especially that opening sequence that's, you know, you're in the short story that he's writing. This is one of those books that uses the comics medium to its ultimate effect. Like every bit about it feels so perfectly calculated.
Right. Right. For sure. And it's on the shorter side as far as an OGN. It's 72 pages.
Right.
You can pick it up now. It's 15 or so bucks. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to get a hard copy of it.
I do
it,
too.
Just because
yeah.
I read it in the digital format and I feel like it would look and feel even better in the physical format. One other thing I wanted to say is, did you ever read Road to Perdition, the comic?
No, I was about to say yes, but no, I was thinking of History of Violence. No, I didn't. I've seen the film. I've heard it's very close to the source material, but I've never gotten around to reading it.
The book, when it came out, felt very progressive and amazing
sure.
and vivid. And I got the same vibes from Pulp as I did from Road to Perdition.
Oh, yeah. I was telling my girlfriend that when I finished reading Pulp, I was like, this is begging to be a film
mm-hmm.
or yeah. like a prestige, like HBO, you know, release or something. Like, I don't know. I'm actually getting choked up thinking about parts of the story. Like, it really got to me. You know, I think it speaks to creatives. It speaks to people who feel like, you know, there's a little bit of imposter syndrome going on with this character and feeling like he hasn't done enough or like he's not the man that he used to be. I a distrust of the people in charge to do what's right.
It's also cool to get a historical fiction. So often, stories are set in modern times, and this
yeah.
is another way to kind of soak in at the time. Mm-hmm. Again, like, it costs a lot of money to make movies and, you know, historical fiction like this that are set in a time where you have to have old cars and old signs and everything.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to do more stories like this in the comic book format. And I hope they do. I know Edward Brecker and Sean Phillips are going to be doing a new series of OGNs, three of which are going to be part of the same story.
Oh, that's rad.
And they're all going to be released next year. So these guys are hard at work, continuing to deliver in this new format, or not, it's not a new format, but in the format that you don't typically see,
right,
in a premier way, from these creators. Some, these guys are both, I would say, legends, living legends in the comic book industry at this point.
I agree.
Especially considering their work on like Criminal and books of that type. So yeah, go check out Pulp.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
And Pulp's a hardcover release too, right? I'm going to have to snag that. I loved it.
That's from Image Comics. In our next segment, top books for next week, we're going to talk about our number one most anticipated book out next week. And I think yours is highly anticipated by many.
Yeah. I'm it's so wild. I think we talked about, maybe it was off mic, but we talked about Coffin Bound a while back. But I'm so excited for Coffin Bound number 5 next week from Dan Waters and Danny. Coffin Bound, I think Ritesh reviewed all the single issues, right, for the site?
He reviewed a bunch. Yeah. I don't know if he reviewed every single one, but yeah.
But then I reviewed the trade for the site, and I felt like we were both like a little baffled by it, but loved it. Like for me, it was a book that like I really dug and wanted to like appreciate more than I did, if that makes sense. Like I really love the vibe of the series. That it's got this very like again, we're going back to the whole dreamlike aspect of it, but it feels like there's not really a linear point to some things. There's some characters that seem manufactured to make you uncomfortable. The violence is very difficult to get past in some of those early issues of Coffin Bound.
Oh, yeah.
But I want the story where the story left us in number 4, which came out, you know, almost a year ago at this point. I feel like maybe, I don't know, this has been the longest year of all time. So maybe it wasn't that long ago, but I desperately want to see what's next and to have more of a sense of closure on that first story arc. I don't know. It's one of the more affecting horror books I've read in a while. It's got a very, Clive Barker-esque vibe to it. I'm wondering how much of the other thing that really appealed to me about the first 4 issues, it feels like a road movie in a way, where they're like moving,
for sure.
And I feel like that part is over. So I'm genuinely curious if the format changes, if it feels like a new series, and it's just such a singular vision that I just want to see what happens next.
I don't know if this is the good way to term it, but it feels like an evil, ethereal story in that there are rules that we can't quite pin down, and it's almost dreamlike and thinly veiled, philosophical and spiritual and symbolic.
Yeah.
And yet I'm not so sure if it has all those things at the same time. It's hard to pin down the book, and it's deeply fascinating in that way.
The first line of my review of the trade is, "What the hell did I just read?"
And I
think what I said was that I think it works better in trade than it does in single issues, because I can't imagine having read that first issue and then thinking, "Yeah, I'll be back next month to see what that was about." Mm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I said was, the story is still full of half-truths and visual metaphors. Like, it doesn't feel...
Yeah.
There's so much in this book that feels like it's not meant to be taken on, like, a surface level, which a lot of Dan Waters' Lucifer is like that, too. It's that kind of a hallucinatory trip. but, yeah, it is... I think there's so much of it that feels like it's going for a vibe more than anything literal. And, it's a very absurdist book. And I'm still just fascinated by it. I mean, like that's the same reason I'm currently rewatching Twin Peaks, where I'm just like, okay, not all of this plays for me, and I don't think that I'm meant to understand it in this context of the media. You know, it's just very strange to really enjoy something and not be 100% sure that I know what I've just experienced. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that some of that is illuminated when the book comes back.
And speaking of illumination, my most anticipated book next week is Giant Size X-Men Phantom X number one, by Jonathan Hickman and Rod Reiss.
Yeah. This was a close second for me.
So I haven't loved every Giant Size book. I love the concept. I love the idea of the writer letting the artist just unleash whatever they want and tell, really just 80% tell the story. Yeah. And
I think Phantom X is tailor-made for a story like that, though. Like a big,
you're right,
bombastic, like spy action story.
Marvel sent me a copy like a week ago, actually. Cool. And so I'm cheating a bit because I've already read it. So it's, anticipated is the wrong word for this one, but I can say with certainty that Phantom X is a character that I've always kind of been drawn to interested in.
Yeah.
I think he has a similar draw as like Logan in that, you know, they both have this mysterious past. Yeah.
What's your deal, bro?
There's a lot revealed here in particular where he's been and, you know, what he's been up to over a long period of time.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Yeah.
And so this book kind of fills us in on the character and some key elements that will, I think, be pertinent to the mainline books. So it also has this purposefulness where it's drawing us into something that'll matter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I assumed that because, I mean, Hickman is doing it, so I feel like it wouldn't be... I don't mean that to be like a dick, but it's like of seeing Hickman on the book, I was like, okay, this isn't like a dispensable tie-in. Like, this is something that we needed to pay attention to.
Oh, totally. I laugh because X-Men that came out this week, it is connected to an Avengers story that he wrote, like, I don't know, 12 years
that
ago.
He loves doing that. It's, you know, Grant Morrison does the same. I mean, he does the same thing where it's like, oh, yeah, you know, you guys don't remember DC 1 million? Well, I guess you better get your trades out.
Right. Also, Rod Reiss is amazing on this. I think he's one of the premier artists working today, similar to, you know, Bill Sienkiewicz or Phil Noto. Sure. His art is incredibly striking and unique compared to others, but also, you know, it's visually stimulating, but also very good at telling the story. So I'm gonna just throw it out there. I think everyone's going to love this book. It is a little bit more money. Oh, yeah. It's at $5, but it's one of my favorite X-Men books of the year.
Oh, wow. And it's been a good year for X-Men.
It has. It really has. Moving on. Judging by the cover, Juniors, our next segment, this is our favorite cover art out next week. I picked The Goddamned Virgin Brides number 2 by R.M. Guerra. This is the sequel series to The Goddamned, the first series Aaron and Guerra did. Oh, God, it's like 5 years old now.
Right,
The cover is a fascinating one to me. It's clearly designed so that the title would be at the center of the page. At the bottom, we have this sword clearly being pulled out of someone because it's covered in blood. At the top, we have two younger people running through some scraggly woods.
Yeah.
And it's just, the cover's telling a story. Obviously, it's the story within, but it's giving me this vibe of, I want to know what's happening. Why is there a bloody sword on the cover? Why are these people running? The first issue was good, and I think this is going to make people want to read the second issue. And I think that's what a good cover does. If you go to the podcast post on aiptcomics.com, you can see the cover yourself.
Yeah, no, it's great. It reminds me of some of the stuff that that DC was doing with the Last God, like those kind like very. It gives me like an immediate like Robert E. Howard vibe.
And it's not often you get basically two panels on a cover, which is what this is. Right?
It's interesting.
Usually, it's one like montaged picture or one
or like
just
a splash.
One image.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your favorite cover art?
I love the cover for Giant Size X-Men Phantom X number 1 by Rod Reiss. I think the big thing that attracts people to Phantom X is his whole attitude and vibe, and just the little touches like
His little Roger Moore-esque, like, cocked eyebrow, I love. This looks like a classic James Bond movie poster kind of thing. Like, or it reminds me of some of, like, Sienkiewicz's, like, crazy, oh, shoot, what's the word I'm looking, then the old Nick Fury covers and stuff like that. It has, like, this kind of very, I don't know, it's a very retro vibe to it.
Yeah, the use of color is insane.
It's wild. And like it looks like either Driving Rain or like an old timey like pop in a film. You know what I mean? Like there's like different, yeah. Like there's, I don't know, there's all these little tiny touches. And I will never not love the goofy ass AIM outfits.
They're like beehive helmets.
Yeah. I just I don't know. There's just a lot to like about this. And immediately when I see a cover that like where the colors pop out, I love the gun is slightly over the logo. You know, like he's busting out.
I like how he's winking too.
Yeah, it's just I don't want to say cute, but it is. Like there's something like very endearing about this cover that makes me immediately want to. And also just I again, it's Phantom X, so I'm just like, my guy's back. Like I want to see what he's up to.
What would you do if you found out this issue revealed? Whenever he opens his cloak, AIM soldiers come out.
I mean, it looks like that. He's got a dark, on the cover, he's got the dark dimension in there, but it's just AIM.
Yeah.
They're That's like, funny. We can't breathe in these things.
Man, Marvel's got, I mean, they should lock down, if they haven't, they should lock down Rod Rice.
Yeah, he's great. Absolutely.
In our last segment, Off Topic, Top Shelf, Nathan gets to tell us what he's interested in right now that's not comics related.
Yeah, so I guess I kind of cheated with this one because it's a little more of a broad subject, but I've been thinking a lot about comfort food TV and comfort food, like, reading. So, like, I was talking to one of my friends recently about how, I mean, obviously there's not a ton of new stuff, new media being made right now for health regulations and stuff, but there's so much like uncertainty in the world that I've found myself not really watching anything new, and I watch a lot of TV. I mean, I watched a lot of TV before I felt scared to leave the house, but the only new shows that I've like watched this year were What We Do in the Shadows, and I watch Doom Patrol every week, and it's my favorite show. But
which you review on AIPT.
I do. Go check it out, guys. I love it. I found myself rewatching. You know, I've been rewatching Community and Broad City and Twin Peaks, and I just restarted The X-Files, so I'll be busy for a minute with that.
Oh, boy.
But it's one of those things where I've been reading about how during times like this, people tend to gravitate towards entertainment where they know how it turns out. They can kind of call the shots. I mean, it's the same thing, I think, you know, as I do with everything, I bring it back to James Bond, but, like, everyone knows James Bond, like, works through a formula. You know, you have the pre-credit sequence, then you have the crazy title sequence, and then he goes and fights somebody, he gets the girl, everything turns out fine. You know how it's going to work. And there's something comforting about that, which is also probably why the franchise has lasted for 60 years or whatever. I've also been rewatching my James Bond box set. I've been rewatching cartoon shows that I loved as a kid, like anything that was in the Toonami lineup from the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. But yeah, it's just, there's something very relaxing about that. And I found myself even just putting things on that I know as background noise. I mean, you look at the number of people who are either just discovering The Office or watching it for the eighth time because it feels like
normal.
It feels like a hug. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, like, what have you been watching anything that, like, similarly, where you're just kind of like, I just want to fall back on something?
Back to the Future, I've watched the entire trilogy twice in the last four months.
Good call. I did that with Indiana
and I
Jones.
Have to say, oh, I rewatched all those. Oh, I didn't watch the fourth
one. No, that's okay.
But I did watch all of those again.
There was a fourth one?
I have to say, like, I've only watched Back to the Future all the way through maybe three times in my entire life, and I watched it twice twice more in the last couple months. I've recently started, I watched all of 30 Rock from the start as well. Yeah, so yeah, it's comfort food, and it's like, oh, life can be back to normal if we just pretend while we watch TV.
I've been rereading you know, like older Golden Age books and stuff. I have these like you know, these artists are like the Showcase Presents collection. So I've been reading through, you know, old Blue Beetle or Elongated Man or Hawkman and stuff like that. Like it just feels, there's something very comforting about simple stories right now too. I mean, as much as we've obviously talked about liking some of the heavier stuff, you know, just look at our top books for this week, but it is nice to be able to kind of not necessarily retreat, but feel that safety blanket, you know?
Oh, for sure. Similar to this show, every single week we come back and we are your safety blanket, so you don't have to worry about what's going on with the news. We're going to get it to you every week. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please like, subscribe, tell your friends, and thanks so much for listening.
Thanks, guys.